Hey, get your fresh bizcast here. I'm DC Dennison. We've got a full show this week. First, Charles Stein talks about why rising oil prices aren't crippling the U.S. economy, at least not yet. He also explains why your 401k has probably plateaued. Then, Keith Reed on the resurgence of the luxury class in rental cars and airlines. And finally, Doreen Vigue and business etiquette expert and Globe columnist Peter Post talk about how to dress for work. First up, Charles Stein. Okay, Charlie Stein, oil hit a new high last week. How come the economy isn't suffering more than it might?
Well, you know, I think it is a surprise, first of all, that the economy isn't suffering more than we'd expect. I think a year ago, if you had said the price of oil is going into the 60s, people would have said we're going to have a recession. And clearly, we're not having a recession. The economy is growing at a pretty good clip. And I think there are a variety of reasons for why that's happening. I think the first is we just don't use as much energy as we once did. Again, that's sort of confounding to people because they say, well, we drive such big cars and we drive so far. But the truth is, it takes less energy to create a dollar of output today than it did 30 years ago, maybe half as much. Some of that is the conservation gains we've made over time. We have better mileage for cars than we did, say, in the 1970s. Factories and other places have conserved, and we don't manufacture the kind of heavy duty things we once did. A lot that those factories have gone away, they've moved to other parts of the world, so we just don't need as much energy to run the economy as we once did. Another way to look at it is if you look at it from the household level, say in the early 1980s when oil prices were very high, households spent something like 8 or 9% of their budgets on energy. Today, it's probably more like 5%. So it just doesn't have the same impact it once did.
So that's on a household basis. What are households conserving? Is it that the appliances are more cost, you know, efficient?
That's right. Yeah. Again, these are real slow gains, and a lot of them, to be fair, happened in the 1980s when we were much more concerned about it. Like, for instance, in cars, we haven't really made any progress in about at least 10 years, maybe more than that. We sort of hit the wall, but we don't go back.
Yeah.
You know, every new washing machine, every new refrigerator is much more energy efficient than the ones they replace. And even as old cars die away, they're replaced by more efficient ones. So we do make gains over time. We don't make the kind of gains they do in other countries where they pay a lot more for fuel, but we still have made gains.
And in the workplace, you could bring in 100 computers to a workplace, a bunch of software, streamline productivity, and you wouldn't be adding virtually anything to the energy bill because those things, computers don't suck a lot of energy.
Right. It's kind of an energy light economy today compared to a lot of the things we do don't use the sort of energy we once did. There's no doubt about it. I think the other thing that's happened that has helped us is sort of the timing of this energy shock or non-shock, as it's turned out to be. At other times when the price of energy has soared, if you think back to the late 1970s and early 1980s, if you think to the early 1990s with the invasion of Kuwait, the economy was already on shaky footing. The price of energy went up, and it was just kind of one more, maybe the straw that broke the camel's back. And here, we don't have a supply shock. The price of oil is high really because the demand is so strong from the United States and particularly the new players like China. It's hitting an economy that's growing. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's almost a sign of strength, not weakness, and therefore we're able to tolerate it because, you know, rates have been low, the economy's been pretty good, the job picture's been pretty good. Oil is a negative, no question. Mm-hmm. It's not a big enough negative to sort of sink all those other things.
Is our view kind of clouded by the fact that you see oil, the price of gas going up at the pump, so you think, oh man, this must be rippling across the whole economy, when in fact, you know, other factors are much bigger, like manufacturing and stuff like that.
You mean for their use of energy?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, cars are probably still the biggest single
they
user
are the biggest?
Of energy.
Oh, okay.
I think they are. So it matters. It's just not, it's not the whole ball of wax.
And it's
still, although we're getting closer, adjusted for inflation, we're not back to the prices of the early 1980s. We'd probably have to get to about $90 a barrel to get that high. And the truth is, as you can tell from people's behavior, it's not yet high enough to change much. You don't hear people say, oh, I was planning to go to grandma's, but yeah, I didn't go. Yeah.
Even if they have a Cadillac Escalade.
Right, right. And it costs $50 yeah. probably to fill up. At yeah. the margin, I'm sure it is starting to make a difference as people go to buy new cars. You can already see the bigger and medium-sized SUVs are not selling as well. There are more hybrids. But those are things like replacing your washing machine that take an awful long time to really make a difference. I don't think we'll see a real break in this until we see either more supply come online or, more likely, demand from someplace slow down. Maybe China will, and we'll get some news from China that says energy use isn't growing as fast as it was. And then you may see prices take a dive.
For people who just follow oil casually, I noticed one figure popped up twice in your story, $100 a barrel.
Right.
I think two different people said it's okay. It's around 60 now. That's high, but when it gets when it hits 100, that could be significant.
I have a feeling it's a little bit arbitrary, and they're looking for a shock value. And remember, we don't buy oil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we buy oil products. Maybe $3 gas will be enough to jar people.
Right.
You know, we're at about $2.40 today, I think, in California, close to $2.70. But maybe nationwide, if we hit $3, people will say, wow, that's really expensive. Or maybe there's a heating equivalent of that. I'm not quite sure what it is. Natural gas, very high as well, too. So, you know, as we come to winter, people may feel it in a double way.
Yeah. Great. Hey, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Right after we finished this conversation, I remembered that Charlie had also just written a column about how the size of the average 401k hasn't risen in years, and in fact has gone down a bit. So I turned the digital recorder back on and asked him about it.
Well, this comes from Fidelity. It's it's not everybody, but they administer something like 8 million 401k accounts, so it's pretty representative. And they found at the end of 2004, the average balance in a 401k account was $61,000. Now, to be fair, some people have IRAs on top of that. Some people have multiple 401ks. They worked in different places. So it probably understates, you know, what they have. But what's particularly distressing is in 1999, the average balance was $64,000.
Oh, wow.
It went down, you know, during the bear market. It's come back up. But basically, even with contributions, people are only back to where they were 6 years ago. And if you think about it, as a person saving for retirement, you know, you've run in place for 6 years.
Wow.
Worse than run in place, really, because you've been putting money in.
Yeah, that's true. And so what does that say about these kind of privatization plans and those kind of...
Well, I think it highlights what, you know, what we were talking about with the ownership society, and that the risk is on you. And in the 90s, it was great. Remember, we ripped open those 401k statements and you were up 15%, up 20%, but here now you've run in place for 6 years, and I think it's quite sobering. Imagine, you know, if you're a middle-aged person, let's say you were 50 6 years ago, and let's say, I did the math on this just on the back of an envelope, and if the market goes up 5% a year going forward, a completely arbitrary number, the market will be back in 2010 to where it was in 2000. So imagine if you have basically a lost decade as a 401k investor, and you started at 50 or 47. That's a long time to not be gaining, really. And that can happen. I mean, you know, we had a great 20-year run, and now we're in the midst of who knows how long is a pretty miserable run.
And you know, people will go through $61,000 pretty fast.
You know, I talked to a financial planner who told me the right way to look at it is you can take out about 4% of that a year.
Oh.
So it'll generate about $2,500. That's pretty small potatoes. Again, people have other sources of retirement, and their houses have appreciated. And things, or they're not, I don't want to paint too bleak a picture, but I think it is sobering. And then on top of that, there's a lot of people who either don't have a 401k or don't contribute to one. Fidelity found that only 66% of the eligible participants put money in over the last year or so. So what about those people? What are they going to have?
Right, they're even less.
And then the other thing people have found over the years is that when people switch jobs, you know, you're supposed to roll it over.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, you know, especially if they don't haven't accumulated that much, you know, they buy a car, they go on vacation, you know, they take the money to do something else.
And they take the loss?
Yeah, it's not that big, I guess. It's another way of getting money. I think it's distressing for those people who, you know, just aren't, you know, there's going to be a certainly segment of people who just do not have enough money to retire on, and it's not as if somebody else is looking out for you.
Yeah, they're on their own.
They're on their own, and I think that's very sobering.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Charlie.
Sure.
Keith Reed, you've written two stories with a similar theme, luxury. And the first one that caught my attention was the one on renting high-end automobiles. Give me the scoop on that.
Well, what you've got is a couple of rental car companies who are out there who are going into a market that used to be strictly for the local player. Hertz and Avis particularly are going after high-end car renters, you know, the business traveler who's on the road, who wants something that's more luxurious than, you know, your regular Ford or Chevy or what have you. The whole lexicon that we're in the United States today, where people are just so, you know, regardless across income levels, everybody wants luxury. Mm-hmm. You know, no matter how you attach luxury to it, you'll even go see if you're out on a Sunday, you can walk through any working class blue collar neighborhood and see a sign up that says luxury condominiums.
Oh,
and,
yeah, right.
You know, well, how do you define a luxury? What's a luxury condominium? Yeah. I thought that would be something that you would see in some exclusive part of town that mm-hmm. cost, you know, a lot of money and had all of these amenities and not be an apartment or a space in somebody's triple decker.
Yeah.
But what that plays to and what this trend in the rental car industry plays to as well is just this whole belief that Americans have that we should be exposed to luxury too.
Yeah.
And it's filtered down the line. So you do have the leisure traveler who normally would have rented some other kind of car, who would have gotten something a lot more similar to what they were renting to what they had at home, or would have rented really based on need. For example, if you've got a family of five or six, you would have rented a minivan mm-hmm. or an SUV.
Right.
Or if you've got, if you're traveling and it's just yourself and a spouse or a companion, you might have tried to find a two-seater or something a little smaller.
Yeah.
Now you've got people who are saying, I'm going to be on the road. I'm gonna travel. I'm going to spend more money for a hotel because I want a nicer room.
Yeah.
I'm going to upgrade, maybe to first class or something when I'm on the plane.
Yeah.
And when I get on the ground, I want the same level of treatment. So I want to feel, and if I got to spend, $100 a day for the rental car as opposed to $50 a day, well, what's $50?
Yeah, right. Wow. Well, that segues right into your Sunday story on the sort of resurgence of first class.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the same kind of thing happening?
I think it's the same kind of thing happening, although on this end it's much more driven by really the airlines mm-hmm. and their need to capture some dollars that, any way they can.
Yeah.
The airlines are out there looking around and they're saying, okay, where can we get the next dollar from? Because, they're doing bad. They're all doing terribly. Yeah.
Right.
There was a problem right after 9/11, where they just didn't have passengers because so many people stopped flying, and then the passengers have come back in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
But now they don't have when the passengers came back, they couldn't charge the fares that they wanted to charge because they had so many people flying, but then they had competitors like JetBlue and AirTran who were killing them on price, and so they couldn't raise the price. Well, now they've got the passengers back.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a lot of the pricing power back.
What's
killing them is they've got to deal with the high cost of jet fuel, of oil. And that's not going away anytime soon. So they're looking to wring any extra dollar that they can out of the passenger, and trying to push people into first class is one of the ways that they can do that.
Did they go too far in their no-frills approach?
I think so.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do also think that. A lot of analysts that I've talked to say, they've gone pretty far. When you start taking away frills, you've got to remember that air travel used to be something very special.
Yeah,
it was all luxury decades ago.
Yeah, right.
And it's become more and more commoditized. So these days, when you get on an airplane, it's a lot like getting a ticket on a Greyhound bus.
Yeah.
A lot of times, when I travel, but most of the time actually, when I'm traveling by train, if I'm headed to New York, it's preferable to me than going on a plane, unless we're talking about speed. It's just a little more comfortable.
Yeah.
There are a lot of other ways that you can travel these days that are much more comfortable than being on an airline. It's a commodity. So for the traveler, or for the airline, actually, when they start taking away those things in coach, it's kind of fine because the coach passenger only cares about the cheapest seat.
Yeah,
it's a commodity to him.
Right.
The first class traveler, the business traveler, the guy who's on the road a lot,
yeah.
the executive who's used to the luxury condo and the luxury car,
yeah.
that guy doesn't want to hear about your woes with jet fuel prices.
Yeah, right.
He wants a hot meal and a blanket and more than pretzels. He wants a drink while he's in the air.
Right.
He wants to be pampered.
Yeah.
He expects that. So when you took away some of that stuff, not in coach, but in first class and at the front of the cabin on that plane, you to a certain extent hurt yourself, probably with some of your best passengers.
And those people, there are those people who are price insensitive.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you've got to have something for them,
right.
or else you're just losing that money.
Well, I had a quote in that story, I think, that came from one of my airline analysts that said the revenue generator is the repeat customer, or something to that effect. I think I butchered the quote, something like that. The point is, people who fly first class tend to be more loyal. If you're paying a lot of money, you're not looking to switch around and jump around. You've probably got a lot of miles on one particular airline, and you've got it because you like the service and you're willing to pay for it no matter what it costs.
Yeah.
When you start to see that service decline, okay, not only are you risking losing a passenger if you're an airline, but what you're really risking the loss of is a passenger who is a repeat customer and who is a customer who was spending more money than the more fickle, fleeting customer who sits back in coach anyway. So you're really losing double. You're not just losing, you know, the guy who's going to fly you once or twice a year and spend $50. You're losing the guy who's going to fly a dozen or 15 or 20 times a year who was spending, you know, $700, $800 a seat or trip.
Huh. Well, you know, just to sum up, it seems that what these two stories have in common is that if you've got a business, it's not just a price business. You've got to have something for the luxury class and the luxury. I mean, even if it's something like chocolate,
right.
you know, or those kind of affordable luxuries,
right.
that's a sector that, even though you hear about hard times and stuff, that there's always that customer, and there's and if you can get them as part of your mix, you're going to do much better.
There's always that customer, and there's always the customer who aspires to it. And it's not just having the guy who, you know, these days it's not just about the guy who earns $250,000 a year and up. It's about the guy who earns $75,000 or $80,000 a year. And who's looking forward to that part of his life when he does make $250,000 a year.
Yeah.
Or the guy who makes $60,000 a year and can figure out a way to cut enough corners to live a little taste of the life of the guy who makes $250,000 and up. So you've got a segment out there that doesn't care about the price at all and doesn't have to. And you've got a segment out there who, even though they've got to care about the price, still wants to enjoy themselves as if they don't have to care about the press.
Yeah, great. Hey, Keith, thanks a lot.
Oh, no problem.
I'm Doreen Vigue, and I'm speaking today with Peter Post of the Emily Post Institute. Peter is the grandson of Emily Post, who everyone knows is the doyen of good manners. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, we wanted to ask you about some topics that touch all of us in the workplace in terms of what to do, what kind of manners we should have when we're at work. Everyone's on deadline. Everyone's stressed. Work is not necessarily thought of as the place where you have to be on your toes, although it really should be. I think people get very used to each other at work, so they maybe let some of their manners slip. So I wanted to ask you about some specific things. Now, most places have dress codes, don't they, Peter?
Actually, a surprising number don't. And that's the first problem we have in the workplace, you know, in terms of dress, attire, that kind of thing, is people not knowing what's okay. Kind of an assumption on management that, well, they'll figure it out and they ought to do what's right type of a thing. And I really encourage management level people to put it down on paper. Have a written policy. Let people, let your workers know. Why? Because you reduce stress in the workplace. If a person doesn't know what to wear, they're going to be stressed about their choices. But if you're telling them, this is okay, this isn't okay, this is the way we do it here, then it like removes that whole questioning, wondering thing on a person's part, and they can simply be dressed for work.
Right.
That's what we want. We want the workplace to be a comfortable place, not a place where we're fostering stress. Goodness knows, we have enough stress as it is from our work. We don't need more added to it for
that
something that's
true.
Not necessary.
Are there some things that no matter what you do for a living, you should just never wear to work?
Well, I think there's some things you should definitely think about for sure. That is that your clothing should be neat, it should be clean, it shouldn't be stained, it shouldn't smell, okay? It should be reasonably appropriate to the workplace area you're going. So if you're going into a workplace where people wear coats and ties, you know, wearing jeans and a pullover shirt just isn't going to cut it. Get yourself dressed to a reasonable amount. Second thing to think about is if you're going to go visit a client, you're going to go visit, you know, somebody outside the office, think about what the people in that office wear. Maybe try to dress up to that if it's dressing up to that so that you look like you fit in, like you're respecting their culture as well. So be cognizant of sort of what's going on around you, but that neatness and that cleanliness, that, you know, all those things, the no odor, no stain stuff, that's true whether you're wearing jeans or you're wearing a suit.
How about piercings, tattoos, and odd hairdos? What if you have a mohawk?
You know, wear a hat. You're making a statement.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, it's a personal statement. If it doesn't go over well in work, don't blame work for not liking it.
Right.
Okay?
Well, you should know your workplace, too. I mean, you should know if you're applying to
exactly.
a button-down kind of business that you may want to, you know, take that that ring out of your eyebrow.
That's exactly right. And don't expect them to just simply roll over and accept your ring when that's not been a part of their culture because you brought it to the culture,
right.
You know. They're not going to like it. You may not get that job. You may not, you know, get that promotion because, you know, they're not comfortable that look. They don't want that look being the kind of look that represents their company. And when you're out representing them with those clients and those prospects, suppliers, people in the street, customers, whatever it might be, if they don't want that look, they're the ones that get to make that decision, not you.
Read Peter Post in the Boston Sunday Globe Business and Money section. He writes a business etiquette column. Peter Post of the Emily Post Institute. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Take care. Bye, Peter.
Bye.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, and check in next Wednesday for a brand new BizCast. Or better yet, subscribe and have BizCast automatically delivered to your computer and MP3 player.